You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Edgar B. Herwick III. I want you to just stop for a second. Stop what you're doing. If you're not in your car, close your eyes. If you are in your car, don't do that. I want you to just take note right now of what you smell. Do you smell anything? If you don't, maybe try to put your wrist up to your nose. You're wearing perfume. Can you smell laundry detergent or fabric softener on your sleeve? Anything like that? See, you might not realize it, but you are in possession of one of the world's most powerful and sensitive instruments, your nose. Roy DeRocher says that you probably are not using it to its fullest capacity. And how would he know? Well, basically, he smells things for a living. So he's with me in the studio now. He's going to explain a little bit about what he does. Roy DeRocher's sensory practice leader at GEI Consultants.
That's correct. We have a group that do this for a living. We have a whole group of people that are trained to use what you described, and we agree is the most sensitive instrument in the world.
Is it really that sensitive?
It is that sensitive. In fact, we can smell things lower than a parpa quadrillion. And to put that in perspective, a parpa quadrillion would be...
You said quadrillion. Like
quadrillion.
Q-U-A-D. How many zeros is in a quadrillion? Do you even know?
There's a whole bunch of examples.
Many zeros.
But just to put that in perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine
filling Gillette Stadium with water.
Okay.
And then imagine one drop of water in that stadium full of water. That's a parpa quadrillion.
That's one part per quadrillion.
That's one parpa quadrillion.
Now, when you say we can smell that, do you mean you can smell that? Or do you mean we human beings can smell that?
The average person.
You know, really?
We worked on an off flavor once in a cracker that people were complaining about a bad taste.
A flavor in a cracker. Okay.
And when we finally identified what the chemistry was, we back calculated, determined it was less than one parpa quadrillion. So less than one drop of water in Gillette Stadium full of water.
Is what was making this thing
with the average person
bad.
Known
and everybody was
taste,
noticing it.
They were complaining about it.
That is unbelievable. Yeah. So let's kind of go back to the beginning here. How does somebody get into the line of work that you're in? Like, what's your background? Like, did you just like to smell things when you were young? And you were like, this is what I want to be when I grow up, a professional smeller.
Oh, I always knew I wanted to be a scientist.
Okay.
But growing up, I wanted to be a chemist.
Okay.
And I never knew this type of thing existed. So I went, I'm a local guy. I went to a local school, Tufts University. I have a degree in chemistry and geology. And I went into flavor chemistry.
And what's flavor chemistry?
Flavor chemistry is understanding all of those compounds, all the chemicals that are responsible for everything we smell and taste. And we use flavor chemistry to develop new products, new flavors, to make things taste better for people.
Okay.
And while I was doing flavor chemistry at this company, I was introduced to sensory analysis, that people actually got paid to train their nose to be a very sensitive instrument,
mm-hmm.
to go around the world, to just smell things and describe what those things smell
this
like.
This is unbelievable. So how did you, what was your first job as like a sensory, and like how did you get started in it?
Well, it was kind of funny because the first company that I went to, I was expecting to get a job as a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in and the head of HR said, I need to ask you a personal question. And I said, sure, anything. I want to get a job. And they said, do you have any objections to drinking beer? And I looked at them and I said, are you kidding me? And I thought it was a trick question. I said, I didn't, you know, want to give the impression I was going to drink on the job.
Totally.
Or,
you're like, I love to drink beer. And they're like, well, we're not hiring you, sir. We're looking for straight and narrow people here.
That's right. And then they went on to describe that they had this serious group based on this very old technology, very powerful technology, to teach people in the beer industry how to taste beer so they can develop better products. And they were looking for a chemist to take over the program, learn how to taste beer, and then go out and teach all the people at all these breweries
to
taste
beer. You're telling me you are on a job interview expecting to get a job as a chemist, and they basically say, would you like to learn how to taste beer for a living?
That's correct.
You're the luckiest guy on earth.
I really, you know, the whole episode on Cheers with Norm getting the job at the brewery, that's how I felt. but then we did a story that was in National Geographic magazine in 1986 on odor work. And I begin to realize how powerful our sense of smell and taste is and to what good uses we could put it. And that's where I got introduced to environmental odor work and how we could help people living in communities that are affected by local factories live a higher quality life by understanding odors in the neighborhoods, understanding who's responsible, understanding where that chemistry is coming from the factories, and then working with these big companies to manage those odors so they don't impact their neighbors.
Okay, so the work that you do now is sort of a combination of all of that stuff. Do you still taste beer? Do you still smell beer? Do you still do that?
We still do the whole range.
Yeah.
At GEI, we do environmental odor work. We do indoor air quality for people that work in an office that might have a smell. On the other side, we do good things like beer and taste wine and chocolate and ice cream. But we also get involved in things that are kind of nasty.
Yeah.
And that the average person might not want to get involved with.
All right. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the nasty stuff a little later, but I want to let people know where I'm talking with Roy DeRochers. He is the sensory practice leader for GEI consultants. Basically, what that means is he uses his nose all day, every day to smell things and improve either the flavor of things or the quality of life in a neighborhood. You name it. If it can be smelled, this man has smelled it. So walk me through just kind of like a typical day. Is more of your work happening? Like, is your work happening in a lab? Is it happening in like a very sort of controlled environment? Are you out, you know, walking up to things and like putting your nose really close to them and smelling them? Typically, like, what would like a typical day be?
Yes to all of the above.
Okay.
The beautiful thing about what we do is we have this instrument, this sensitive nose as an instrument, that is very mobile. So we don't have to just sit in a lab. We do at times.
Yeah.
We sit in a controlled room with controlled temperature and humidity and lighting to do certain experiments. But we can also take the instrument very easily by getting up and walking out the door to go into a community and literally drive around a neighborhood with our heads hanging out the window, smelling what's in the air.
So what's an example of a, you know, a job where you sort of get a call and have to drive out into a neighborhood and you're going around smelling in the air?
Well, we many years ago, we worked on a fascinating job in Boston during the Big Dig.
Okay.
When they were building the Ted Williams Tunnel. And as they were digging into the marine sediment, they were kicking up some odors that workers got very concerned and said, we don't want to work anymore. And they stopped working.
Because of this odor.
Because
what
of
was
the odor.
Odor.
It was an onion-like odor. It was very pungent, very onion. Huh. And they were asking, is this healthy? What is it?
Sure.
And they brought instruments out and they did measurements and they didn't find anything. The reason they didn't find anything is the odor was there at a concentration lower than the instruments could detect.
What can an
but
instrument
still,
detect?
Instruments get down around the part per billion.
But you're saying we're part per quadrillion, you
or
and
less.
Me, with noses. Or
we,
less.
We are part per quadrillion.
We're better than technology.
We are much better. We think that the human
you're
nose...
You're saving humanity right here.
We can save humanity with the nose.
You are making me believe in people over computers right now. This is great.
Well, I'll tell you, in the industry, there's a big push for electronic noses, machines to do this job.
Huh.
But they don't work. They don't work in the applications because they're not sensitive enough. And everybody that puts these in their factories are at risk of off flavors, off odors that are at levels below the detection limits getting through, and then the average human who can pick it up seeing it and complaining and having a problem.
Wow.
So it's a big challenge to replace the nose with an instrument. We're not even close yet.
Take that, Google. Take that, Google. Write a nose algorithm. All right, so I took you off the path there, but what happened with the Big Dig? So you went out there, was like an onion smell, so you show up.
So we show
up
and the first thing we do is we get our boots on and we get out of the car and we start walking through the mud, past all the drilling rigs, past all the equipment, sniffing around. We get down close to the ground. We literally stick our nose in the mud, you know, to see what we smell. We get outside
of the
tunnel.
You like stick it right in there? I mean, like, are you just like bravely smell? You're just like, I don't care. I'm just going to smell.
We're down on our hands and knees and sniffing away and picking up where we think their odor exists.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we needed to do was to get some air samples to bring to our lab to do some of this sensory work.
How do you capture air? You just...
So we have what looks like an artificial lung,
uh-huh,
with a bag inside of it, and we can pump that lung so that the bag will fill up.
Yeah.
And then we just put a sample tube wherever we want to collect air.
Huh.
So if we get down and we smell in the mud and we see a patch of mud that smells like what people are complaining about...
Yeah.
We can then put something down there, a little funnel or something, and collect the air off that mud,
yeah,
and collect that odor so that we can bring it back and do,
wow,
some smelling. Pretty powerful. The other thing we can do is we integrate the human nose with instrumentation.
Okay, so how does that work?
So there's an instrument called a gas chromatograph.
Mm-hmm.
And normally you put in samples, and this instrument separates things out and identifies what all the components are.
It does it by burning it, or how does it do it?
It heats it up so that it becomes a gas, and it sends it through a column, and different compounds travel different times through the column.
Yeah.
So by the time it reaches the end of the column, everything's separated.
So is this the kind of thing that they have on like those Mars rovers where they're sort of scooping up and like analyzing analyzing the dirt there. It's the same kind of thing?
Very similar technology. Cool. So what we do is when the compounds reach the end of the instrument, normally there's a mechanical detector.
Yeah.
And it has limits around a part per billion. What we do is take that off and put a funnel there so we can smell right from the instrument. Now we can smell at less than a part per quadrillion. We will smell things that the instrument wasn't picking up, but that are there.
Like what, like individual compounds, chemicals? Like you can be like, that's argon, like that's neon. Can you know what those smells are?
Yes.
That's crazy. How did you learn that? I mean, how do you train yourself to know that? Is it just doing it?
Yeah, it's a question we get asked all the time. The only difference between people like myself, professional smellers, and the average person is that I have a vocabulary to describe in very objective terms what I'm smelling. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying this is a bad smell, this is a good smell, I can say, well, this is isobutyric acid, or this is this compound. And the way that we learn that is by practice.
Yeah.
We smell all the different flavors, all the different odors at different concentrations over and over again until you memorize that's what that smells like, this is what that smells like. So if I walk into a building and I smell butyric acid, I say, there's butyric acid in here, or there's isoamyl acetate, or there's whatever compound I'm picking up.
And are you just like walking around all the time picking up things that nobody else is picking up? Like, are you like, it's sort of, on some level it feels like you're a superhero. Like you like walk into a Dunkin' Donuts, I'm like, oh, this smells good. It smells like donuts. And you're walking in and you're like, well, it smells like they just cleaned this place with this soap probably 20 minutes ago. Or like, what like, are you getting more information than most people because you have this vocabulary?
I am. And a lot of people who do what I do have that experience. But in general, it's the positive side of that experience, not the negative.
Okay.
Some people will ask me, am I more critical when I go out to eat? Or am I more critical of my wife's perfume? Or, and we say, no, we turn it off.
So you can kind of turn it on.
We can turn it on and off. But we tend to have, people like myself, tend to have more appreciation for, you know, if you walk past a restaurant and something smells really good,
yeah,
I'll stop for a second and I'll smell it. I'll go find out what the smell is.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to do that all the time. Whenever you smell something interesting, stop for a minute and find out what it is, because you're going to learn something and it's going to really improve and make your life even happier than what it currently
is. Build your vocabulary. I'm talking with Roy DeRocher. He's a sensory practice leader at GEI Consultants. And what that means basically is that he smells things professionally for a living. He has tuned his nose and his vocabulary about what he's smelling to such a degree that he can do this professionally. He does this for lots of companies, cities, towns, you name it sounds like. Roy, a couple of times through this conversation, you've said you've mentioned tasting things as well as part of what you do. What's the relationship between tasting and smelling?
Well, this is a big secret to the average person, that we really don't taste much in the mouth. In the mouth, we have
a tongue. What do you mean by that?
In the mouth, we have a tongue.
Okay.
And on that tongue, we have taste buds. But our taste buds only taste five things: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. Okay. We don't taste chocolate, we don't taste vanilla, we don't taste meat, poultry, pizza. In your mouth, we don't have an instrument. All we taste on the tongue, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. Everything else that you think you're tasting is actually chemistry that gets in your mouth when you chew things up, and it gets in your saliva, and it gets in the air in your mouth, and it travels up the back passage into your nose. This is why people will often say, I can't taste anything this week, I have a cold. What they really mean to say is, my nose is so congested, I can't smell what I'm eating.
Okay, so I get a steak, right? And there's a lot of salt on the steak.
Right.
The only thing that my tongue is tasting is the salt, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
And the rest of it, I'm smelling.
Correct. And I would encourage anyone out there listening, and do this when you get home, hold your nose.
Okay.
Hold your nose when you eat something, chew it up, see what it tastes like, then let your nose go. You will be amazed that you'll blank out on everything you think you're tasting except sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. We do a demonstration when we do training using wintergreen lifesavers.
Okay.
Hold your nose.
Yeah.
Lick the lifesaver.
Yep.
See what you taste. Keep holding your nose, and all of a sudden, let your nose go and see what happens.
Do you get this like what?
It's like fireworks.
Really?
It's pow! It goes
look
on.
Out.
Yeah.
All right. That sounds great. All right. I'm talking with Roy DeRocher. He's a sensory practice leader at GEI Consultants, i.e., professional smeller. Okay. What was it let's go back again, the big dig thing. What did you find there? What was the onion smell?
Well, this was a complex natural mechanism. It was, it involved some of the de-icing agents from years and years ago from the airport getting into the marine sediment. And it was a natural process. Bacteria in the sediment was feeding on these glycols, these de-icing agents, And one of the byproducts of them eating it was this onion odor. Perfectly healthy, wouldn't hurt anybody, but a very powerful compound. We could smell it at very low levels. In fact, that was a compound that you could smell at less than a part per quadrillion.
Think about something like an onion, right? Like you talk about an onion smell, or like that word pungent. It seems like a strong smell. Like onion has a very sort of defined, strong smell. What's different about an onion than something else that smells? Is there more of it? Like you're talking about this like parts per quadrillion. When you smell an onion, is it just that there's lots of things to smell, or are there some smells that are stronger somehow? What causes the differentiation?
In the case of an onion, it's that there's complex chemistry. What you smell that you call an onion isn't necessarily the same compound that you're smelling that's causing the pungency. Pungency is irritation. So within an onion, which is a natural product, there's lots of chemistry. Some of that chemistry give the onion its smell, the onion smell. Some of that chemistry gives you the irritation. And that's why out there in the world, you know, there's a lot of research done on what compounds cause irritation, for good and bad. Mm. For good, it's we want to know those compounds so we can put it into spicy sauces and things that people want. For the bad side, we want to train people to know what compounds cause irritation because they're early warning signals that something bad might be about to happen. So there's a lot of science around that kind of chemistry. But in an onion, it's all because you've got it all coexisting in an onion, whereas in a beet, you just have stuff that makes it taste like a beet. You don't have chemistry that gives you that pain or that irritation.
Really interesting stuff. So I want to, Roy, let you know about this comment we got from Susan on Facebook. All right, she said she gave us some of her favorite and least favorite scents. She says one of her least favorite is muddy river, the smell of a muddy river. She says bad scent there. One of her best smells, she says, roasted nuts on Park Street, also fresh snow. So it's snowy out there today. Does snow have a smell? Does it smell the same everywhere? Does it smell different when it's fresh, when it's not fresh?
Absolutely, snow has a smell, first of all.
Yeah.
Typically, when people say fresh snow is a nice smell, they like it. It's because the air in general smells cleaner. The snow is literally stripping odors out of the air. But yes, snow can smell different and more importantly, taste different when it dissolves in your mouth. Mm. Different parts of the world, depending on what's in the atmosphere. If you're in a city that has a lot of smog, the snow is going to pick up a lot more chemistry as it travels down.
Beijing or L.A.
Then let's say if you're sitting up in Vermont or somewhere where the air is much cleaner, there's less industry, and it's a more natural, cleaner water that's forming the snow.
Really interesting stuff. Roy, can I put you on the spot? Because I want to hear you talk about like your vocabulary a little bit. I'm looking. I've got a highlighter here, which is something I think of as having a smell. Can I have you smell this highlighter and sort of describe in the vocabulary you have a little bit what you're smelling here?
Sure.
All right,
sure.
Cool. So experiment going on right now here on Boston Public Radio. We've got Roy DeRocher, professional smeller, smelling a highlighter. Describe.
So this is a sensory quiz. I love sensory quizzes. The first thing you get is you get a moderate intensity solvent note, which is an acetate. It's in the acetate group, probably ethyl acetate. Could be a little bit of amyl acetate. The difference is ethyl is solventy. Amyl is a little more banana-like.
I always get that. I'm with you on the banana thing.
And then underneath that, you've got some other fruity notes that are part of that solventy, and they're citrus notes. And in this case, it's more like a lemon-lime than it is grapefruit or orange. Now, there also is a little bit of musty smell.
Okay.
Musty compounds are very aggressive, and it's probably the carrier of the liquid that's in here. But this kind of musty is not like the ruddy, the muddy riverbank that Susan wrote in.
It's not Susan's muddy riverbank.
This is more like a compound called methyl isoborneol, which smells like dirt out on the sidewalk. It's a dry musty, not a wet, muddy musty. And that has a little bit of this. There is a little bit of pungency here. There's also a little bit of cooling. We call that a nose fail. So as you're smelling this, it's almost as if you had some mint or menthol, some cooling in there. And then kind of if you wait a few minutes, you get a little bit of a cardboardy smell.
Yeah.
And cardboardy smells come from compounds in here that are oxidizing. They're getting old. So this has probably been around for a little while, and we can tell by picking up that little bit of cardboardy
smell.
That
is awesome. You must kill it at wine tastings. You probably just go in there and just blow everybody out of the water.
we really enjoy the wine industry. We do a lot of work in the wine industry.
Sure.
And I've trained panelists and done a lot of work for Gala Wine out in California, a lot of global stuff. But yeah, you imagine wine people, they love just talking descriptively about wine.
Developing that vocabulary.
Yeah,
like
it's
you
one
say,
of those
yeah.
industries where people really pay attention and they sell kits that have different flavors in it you can practice with before you taste wine. And it's a perfect example of the type of stuff we do.
That's good stuff. All right, Roy, before we go, we've only got a few minutes left. You mentioned some horror stories earlier about this, you know, so you get to smell a lot of good things and taste a lot of good things like beer and chocolate and coffee, but also some bad stuff too. Can you give us a horror story or two?
Yeah, and this is the stuff that my friends hate to hear these stories because they love the beer tasting stories. But when I tell them that we have to smell used feminine napkins, and they say, why do you have to do that? And I say, well, we got to test the deodorant. Or we have to smell kitty litter boxes that have been used by cats for 3 weeks.
Ooh.
Or we have to smell mattresses that are, you know, 50 years old and have been in somebody's house that you probably don't want to go in.
Dear Lord.
Or do an environmental odor project on a wastewater treatment facility where everything from your bathroom to the sewers goes to that facility. And you've got to get down close to the water and smell the smells that are coming off those tanks. Those aren't as fun.
You guys get paid more for those? I mean, you get paid more for a job like that than you do for, like, tasting coffee and delicious chocolate.
Sometimes I think we should get hazardous pay for some of those interesting projects
that we work on. That's really interesting. Now, Roy, I noticed that you have a mustache.
Does this
mustache help you in your work, or is it just coincidence?
Is it
a functional mustache?
It's not a functional mustache.
Okay.
It actually can be a problem at times.
Really?
Because if we're doing environmental odor work and we're standing in a neighborhood that stinks,
yeah,
while you're standing there, you begin to blank out. You begin to not be able to smell the odor. And what we do is we have these masks with carbon filters that we'll put over our nose and smell clean, filtered air for a while.
Palate cleanser.
Right.
It's the sorbet for the nose.
The sorbet for the nose.
Yeah.
And we'll breathe for a few minutes, and then we'll be able to smell. Well, if you've got facial hair like my mustache, it's hard to get a seal. And so when we're working on those types of projects, I either have to shave it off or cut it back so I can get a good seal with the filters.
Right.
But that's the only function it has.
Okay, so real quick, because we're just about done here. Advice for those of us who have heard this segment and are like, you know what? I want to develop my vocabulary a little bit. I want to smell a little better. What can we do?
Ask questions.
Okay.
Whether you're at someone's house and they've cooked dinner and you taste something interesting, hey, how did you make this? What did you use? If you're at a restaurant, even if you're walking down the street and you smell something different, stop for a minute and find out what it is. And if you do that, you'll build up a better, more objective vocabulary for all these types of things.
All right. Roy DeRocher, sensory practice leader at GEI Consultants, i.e. guy who smells all kinds of stuff for a living. Hey, thanks for being with us here on Boston Public Radio today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I smell Callie Crossley back in the studio. What a lovely odor. What a lovely scent.
I'm going to ask this guy if he can smell my perfume. But anyway, thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great afternoon and smell the roses.